Introducing a new association of churches in Mid-America, MARBAC. The Mid-America Reformed Baptist Association of Churches is a regional association for Reformed Baptist churches holding to the 1689 Confession of Faith, with a goal of partnering together for the advance of the gospel and supporting and planting churches in the region. To learn more or find out how you can be involved, visit marbac.org. That's MARBAC.org. You are listening to the Weekly Discourse on the Man of God Network, featuring a weekly lecture from the classroom of Covenant Baptist Theological Seminary.
The rise of postmillennialism. Now, postmillennialism grew up gradually in the general context of the Puritan movement in the British Isles. Ian Murray, in his book, The Puritan Hope, which is well worth a read. Someone wanted to read it for this class, and I said, no, I've got other reading I want you to do. But that doesn't mean I don't like the book. I don't agree with Ian Murray, who's a postmillennialist, and is out about the business of defending postmillennialism, I think, in this book. But The Puritan Hope carefully traces the development of these increasingly postmillennial expectations. The development begins, he says, with the teaching of the restoration or future conversion of the Jews by two fathers of the Reform movement in Britain. Where are we? Mark, would you read that quotation from Ian Murray there?
Yes. One of the first developments in thought of prophecy came as a further attention was given to the scriptures bearing on the future of the Jews. Neither Luther nor Calvin saw a future general conversion of the Jews promised in Scripture. Some of their contemporaries, notably Martin Bucer and Peter Martyr, who taught at Cambridge and Oxford respectively in the reign of Edward VI, did understand the Bible to teach a future calling of the Jews. In this view, they were followed by Theodore Beza, Calvin's successor in Geneva, as early as 1560, 400 years before Calvin's death. The English and the Scots refugees, Protestant leaders who produced the Geneva Bible expressed this belief in their marginal notes on Romans chapter 11, verses 15 and 26. On the latter verse, they comment, "He soweth that the time shall come that the whole nation of the Jews, though not everyone particularly, shall be joined to the Church of Christ."
Okay. So you have this, the Geneva Bible, okay, with a marginal note that says that Romans 11 is talking about the conversion of the Jews into the Church. Okay, that's a different thing that we hear nowadays. But the point is, that was the beginning, Murray thinks, of the development of postmillennialism. So then Murray traces how this belief became common among Puritans and concludes, from the first quarter of the 17th century, belief in a future conversion of the Jews became commonplace among the English Puritans. Martyr's view was that this conversion of the Jews was to be one of the climactic events of history. So it's the last thing that happens. Jews are converted. Christ comes back. Okay? Later developments led, however, to the expectation that there would be associated with the conversion of the Jews, okay, now the next step, a further glorious calling of the Gentiles. Some Puritans took the final step, then, of identifying this future period of blessing for the church with 1,000 years of Revelation 20. 1,000 years was, of course, interpreted figuratively, and with this happened, a systematic postmillennialism was born. So you have conversion of the Jews, first step. The conversion of the Jews leads to a massive work of Christ among the Gentiles, second step. Third step, this is what the millennium is. Well, that's where Edwards is, okay? So there you have a handy-dandy chart to help you visualize that. Okay. Now, Murray's statement that what we would call postmillennialism was to command very wide support in 18th and early 19th century Protestantism is certainly accurate. And this belief is the context in which we come to our next point. Okay. So, a lot of times, postmillennialism is kind of hammered with the idea that it's kind of an enlightenment, a product of enlightenment optimism. But if Murray is right, and I think he is, Though the optimism of the Enlightenment from 1700 to at least into the 1900s was a nice context in which for postmillennialism to grow and to prosper. Nonetheless, Murray's showing that there were, you know, roots of it in the Puritan movement. You just can't ascribe it to modernism, okay? Postmillennialism is ascribed to modernism in a lot of circles. It's the optimistic liberalism. It's modernism. I was taught such stuff as that when I was being raised in a premillennial context. But that's really not quite fair. All right, now we're coming, having looked at the rise of postmillennialism in the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, to the reaction of premillennialism, what I've called antithesis. And the first thing I want to talk about is the identity of early premillennialism. Premillennialism arose in the 1800s in reaction to the dominant postmillennial viewpoint we have just mentioned. And you won't understand it, and you won't understand its attraction till you understand that it arose in a postmillennial context. Okay? For the early premillennialists, in other words, there were two options: postmillennialism or premillennialism. The identity of this resurgent premillennialism also cannot be understood unless one realizes that the dominant Protestant method of interpreting prophetic scripture was the historicism described earlier. Although early premillennialism arose in reaction to postmillennialism, both the postmillennialism and the premillennialism of the early 1800s was historicist in its method of prophetic interpretation. Now, let me ask you a question. What is the common, take the choices, historicist, preterist, futurist, what is the common method of prophetic interpretation in modern evangelicalism? It's futurism, of course it is. Dispensationalism assumes a futurist interpretation of the book of Revelation. But this is not true of the premillennialism that arose in the 1800s. That premillennialism was historicist. Now, these observations on the identity of resurgent British premillennialisms are confirmed by the research and interpretations of Ernest Sandeen in an important book called The Roots of Fundamentalism. The resurgence of premillennialism in the early 1800s was sparked, according to Sandeen, by three factors. Sandeen deals with these three factors in a chapter entitled The Revival of British Millenarianism. Those factors were a new passion for the interpretation of prophecy, first of all. Historical events, often, Nathan and I were talking about it during the break, the postmillennialism thrived in the optimism of the Enlightenment. Premillennialism thrived in the disastrous 20th century with the two world wars and the Cold War and two-thirds of the world controlled by monsters like Hitler and Stalin. Dreadful period of time to live in. We have a hard time going back and identifying with it. And then the Cold War of MAD. You know what MAD is? No, you're too young to know what MAD is. You know what MAD is because you've heard it from me, right? Or is it from someplace else? I have asked whole classes. Oh, maybe you did. That would be amazing. I've asked whole classes of Kentucky Wesleyan students, assuming a few of them would know what MAD was, and they don't know. MAD is, tell us, Andrew.
Mutually assured destruction.
Yeah. Of both the United States and the Soviet Union had a loaded nuclear pistol pointed at the other's head, and it was that deterred the Third World War, right? Terrible time in which to live. No wonder that that premillennialism, especially of the dispensational variety, especially with its tendency to a very pessimistic views, prospered in that kind of context. Well, historical events have a lot to do, sadly, you might say, with prophecy and prophetic positions. And this is true in the early 1800s. Sandeen says, in the first place, then, the British millenarian revival was characterized by a new passion for the interpretation of the prophetic scriptures. And this was connected with the French Revolution and with Napoleon, who looked a few people like, well, the Antichrist or like the beast that was going to destroy Babylon and then conquer the earth. Okay? Particularly arresting to the prophetic thought of the day was the way in which the French Revolution curtailed the power of the Church of Rome. Liana, would you like to read? Can you read that statement?
I think so. The revolution brought the cheering sight of the destruction of papal power in France, the confiscation of church property, and eventually the establishment of a religion of reason. The final act occurred in 1798 when French troops under Berthier marched on Rome, established a republic, and sent the Pope into banishment. Commentators were quick to point out that this deadly wound had been explicitly described and dated in Revelation 13. The identification of the events of the 1790s with those prophesied in Daniel 7 and Revelation 13 provided biblical commentators with a prophetic Rosetta Stone. At last, a key had been found with which to crack the code. There could now be general agreement upon one fixed point of correlation between prophecy and history. After 1799, in Egyptology as in prophecy, it seemed as though there were no limits to the possibility of discovery.
Isn't that interesting? Okay. His comments make clear that the premillennial revival was originally of an historicist kind of premillennialism. In a strange way, the Protestant assumption that the papacy was the Antichrist served to ignite in the late 18th century a renewed interest in the prophetic scriptures. The French Revolution's assault upon the papacy looked amazingly prophetic to Protestant and historicist interpreters. And so these convictions were connected with the revival of premillennialism which followed. There's a second factor. It's a renewed interest in the condition of the Jews. The renewed interest in premillennialism was also connected with a renewal of interest in the condition of the Jews. As we have seen, interest in the Jews and their conversion was deeply rooted in the Puritan eschatological expectations. Of course, there it was normally connected with an Augustinian or postmillennial outlook. Thirdly, revive faith in the imminent return of Christ. Now pay special attention to this one because this has all sorts of consequences. A third aspect of this millenarian revival was renewed interest in the idea of the imminent return of Christ. It seemed evident that an imminent return of Christ could not be consistent with a postmillennial return of Christ. Because after all, unless you were already in the millennium, they didn't believe that, most of them, you had at least the whole millennium to wait before Christ was going to come back. And so how could you believe in an imminent return of Christ in any sense, inconsistent with postmillennialism? So if your options are postmillennialism and premillennialism, and you believe in the imminent return of Christ, there's only one choice, right? Premillennialism. And Sandine underscores the way in which premillennialism would have struck believers in a day dominated by a postmillennial outlook. Would you read that for us, Jerry?
I'll have to get a little closer.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right.
Eyes on her.
The doctrine of the premillennial advent, the third aspect of the millenarian revival, seemed novel, probably mistaken, possibly heretical to most Anglicans of the day. In keeping with the standard Whitbian eschatology, Christians had not been taught to expect the second coming during their own lives. The second advent, they felt, would occur only after the millennium and therefore must be more than 1,000 years away. Many of the clergy had never troubled themselves over this kind of bewildering eschatological question or were frankly skeptical of the divine import of the apocalyptic mysteries of Daniel and Revelation.
Mm-hmm. Now, these words suggest that the premillennialism of the early 1800s was a kind of biblical and believing, because I think the idea of the imminent return of Christ, at least properly defined, is biblical. And there were a kind of biblical and believing reaction against the lack of emphasis upon Christ's second coming and a reaction toward the emphasis of the New Testament upon the imminence and practical importance of Christ's second coming for Christians. The imminent return of Christ was taught on the face of the New Testament and seemed compatible only with a premillennial eschatology. Make sense? Now, the reason for this must be appreciated. In a context where everyone assumed that some kind of millennium awaited the church in the future, the only doctrine which seemed consistent with the doctrine of the imminence of Christ's second coming was one in which Christ returned before the 1,000 years and not afterwards. And so it was obvious that you had to be, if you believed the Bible, a premillennialist. All right, there you have it. The fall of historicist premillennialism. The early historicist premillennialism in a few decades received a deadly wound, to paraphrase the book of Revelation, of its own. Historicist prophetic interpretation of a premillennial variety was made to order for the date-setting mania that often accompanies renewed interest in prophecy. Says Sandeen, William Miller illustrated with telling exaggeration a fundamental dilemma of the historicist school of millenarians. Chronology formed the structure of their dogma. They had tied themselves to a prophetic timetable derived from the events predicted in the Bible, especially Revelation. Although the non-Millerite millenarians seldom became committed to a specific month and day, there was scarcely a year that passed without one or another millenarian expectation being disappointed. This was particularly true from 1843 to 1848 and again from 1867 to 1870, when prophetic calculation and civil unrest coincided to bring expectations to a boil. Now, William Miller was an American. He's well known as the progenitor of the various Adventist denominations, the most famous of which are the Seventh-day Adventists, but there are actually a number of Adventist denominations that came out of the splintering of the Millerite movement in the early 1800s. Now, his views were not derived, apparently, in any direct sense from British millenarians, yet they paralleled that of British historicist premillennialists in a remarkable way. Sandeen remarks, the most famous millenarian in American history, William Miller, was far from being a fanatic, a self-educated farmer from Loehampton, New York. He showed no interest in prophecy during his early years and was, in fact, something of a skeptic until converted in 1816. During the next few years, precisely at the time that British prophetic interest began to stir, Miller became fascinated with interpretation of prophecy. Depending almost entirely upon his own exegesis of the Bible, Miller developed a system of prophetic interpretation that came remarkably close to duplicating that being developed by the historicist premillennialist of Britain. William Miller taught a doctrine of the last times that differed remarkably little from that proclaimed by the British 19th century millenarians. The main thrust of Miller's teaching was that Christ would return, the wicked be judged, and the world cleansed by fire, about 1843. His convictions were founded upon the same assumptions as were those of the historicist premillenarians in Britain, that the prophecies of the Bible were always literally fulfilled, and that chronological sequences in the apocalyptic books should be interpreted according to the year-day theory. Now, the Waterloo of historicist premillennialism in America is graphically described by Sandeen. On October 22, 1844, the sun sank as it had on every other day since creation, and Christ did not come. In retrospect, the Millerite movement appears to have virtually destroyed premillennialism in America for a generation. Most of those to whom a more diffuse millenarian movement, similar to that of Great Britain, might have appealed were reached instead by the Millerites and either converted and disillusioned or else disillusioned immediately. In the wake of the tragedy of 1844, who could lift up his head and proclaim the message of an imminent advent? Miller's success before 1844 is matched only by the difficulties he created for anyone brave enough to attempt to preach a millenarian message after 1844. Took a long time for America to forget William Miller. So, though not as dramatically, yet similar disappointments recurred in historicist premillennialism in Britain. So we're not the first generation of Christians in which false teachers have claimed to have succeeded in calculating the time of Christ's advent. Again and again, in the history of the church, the folly and pride of those who have claimed to calculate the time of Christ's second advent have been exposed for what they are. How easily overlooked are the plain admonitions of the New Testament that such an attempt and endeavor is impossible. Matthew 24:36. Now, one result of the disaster of historicist prophetic predictions is highly important for us today. If we're to understand the background of the contemporary prophetic scene among evangelicals, we must understand that the blunders and disappointments of historicist premillennialism contributed to the appeal of a new premillennialism. And this new form of premillennialism is marked by the futurist method of prophetic interpretation. Sandine remarks, after 1844, the historicist position began to lose the almost undisputed position that it held during the first generation of the millenarian movement. Futurism, the competing eschatology of Irish millenarians and the Plymouth Brethren, gradually became more prominent during the 1840s and eventually commanded the adherence of a great part of the British and especially the United States millenarians. Which brings us to the rise of futurist premillennialism. The rise of futurist premillennialism. Any questions at this point? So the genesis of futurism can be traced to the influence of Edward Irving. Oh, important name. In 1826, Irving came into the possession of a book written by Manuel Lacunza, The Coming of Christ in Glory and Majesty. As might be expected from one converted out of a Jesuit background, the method of prophetic interpretation utilized in Lacunza's book was futurism. Mark Sarver says, as concerns the developments leading up to the emergence of dispensationalism, the primary significance of Lacunza's work lay in its futurism with reference to the interpretation of the book of Revelation. The futurism popularized by Irving is the backdrop and context of the development of dispensationalism. I don't know if I say anything more about Irving. Irving is significant not only because futurist premillennialism seemed to have developed in his church, but also because the church was one of the first marked by what were thought to be the restoration of the spiritual gifts of prophecy and tongue speaking. In fact, they had offices in Irving's church eventually for prophets and apostles. Okay. Now, there were futurists who were not dispensational, but dispensationalists grew and could only grow on the futurist ground plowed by Irving. The precise details are somewhat obscure, but it seems clear that the secret or pre-tribulational rapture theory emerged from within the context of the revival of spiritual gifts in Irving's congregation. What's the secret of pre-tribulational rapture theory? Most of you know what it is. You've been taught it. It is the view that Christ will come secretly and invisibly to take his church out of the world before the beginning of the future great tribulation, hence pre-tribulational. Now, this taking of the church out of the world is identified as the rapture by those who hold the pre-tribulational theory. In fact, many people, if you say rapture, think of pre-tribulationism, and will even say if they're not pre-tribulationists that they don't believe in the rapture. Actually, the term rapture is, I think, if I remember correct, derived from a Latin word which translates the whole idea of the catching up of 1 Thessalonians 4. You know, it's perfectly legitimate to believe in the rapture. If you buy that, you simply mean the catching up of Christians at Christ's second coming to meet him in the air. That's all that rapture means. But the problem is, to many people, the term rapture has become synonymous with pre-tribulationism. Now, so it involves the resurrection of dead Christians and the transformation of living Christians, and both meet the Lord in the air. So you see the chart there of the secret or pre-tribulational rapture theory. Okay? Christ comes secretly and pre-tribulationally prior to the great tribulation, and then Christ is revealed in glory subsequent to the great tribulation, but before the millennium. Hence, many churches today are the two pre's. Pre-tribulational and premillennial. Christ comes before the tribulation, and he comes before the millennium. Now, this theory was given a considerable measure of acceptance at the Powers Court conferences in 1831 and 1833, which apparently kind of Bible conference held among the circle of people familiar with Darby and Irving. Irving and Darby were both present at these conferences. Darby built dispensationalism upon the foundation laid by Irving. Many of his emphases may be found in seed form in Irving. He taught a pessimistic view of the future until Christ's second advent. He emphasized the apostasy of the churches and urged believers to withdraw into what became the Plymouth Brethren Assemblies. Leave your corrupt churches, gather together in little Bible studies, celebrate the Lord's Supper, and this became the Plymouth Brethren movement. To defend the secret rapture theory of an any-moment pre-tribulational coming of Christ, he emphasized, and you have to do this, as I will argue, the distinction between Israel and the church. To have pre-tribulationism, you must have the church-Israel distinction. You can have the church-Israel distinction, I guess, and not be pre-tribulational, but you cannot be pre-tribulational, logically speaking, and not hold the church-Israel distinction. And I'll show you why that's the case as we come to the subject. This distinction between the church and Israel was both novel and crucial to the defense of Darby's system. Ian Murray remarks, at Albury and in Irving's London congregation, a curious belief, practically unknown in earlier church history, had arisen, namely, that Christ appearing before the millennium is to be in two stages. The first, a secret rapture, removing the church before our great tribulation, smites the earth. The second is coming with the saints to set up his kingdom. This idea comes into full prominence in Darby. He held that the church is a mystery, of which only Paul speaks. She is Christ's mystic body, will be complete at the rapture. The Jews and other Gentiles converted thereafter will never be Christ's bride. I deny, said Darby, that the saints before Christ's first coming or after a second are part of the church. So with breathtaking dogmatism, Darby swept away what had previously been axiomatic in Christian theology. Now, with the emergence of what is known as dispensational premillennialism, or simply dispensationalism, a distinctly different form of premillennialism, and indeed a distinctly different system of eschatology, had been brought to birth. It differed from historic, or what's also called covenant premillennialism, in two respects. It separated or distinguished Israel and the church, and it taught a secret pre-tribulational return of Christ. Here's the system. That's historic premillennialism, called so because it was the premillennialism taught in the early church. The idea that the church is the new Israel of God. So it's the church that reigns with Christ for the 1,000 years after the second coming of Christ. It's not physical Israel. It's the church, the new Israel of God. That's called historic premillennialism because, frankly, it was the historic version of it in the early church. It's called covenant premillennialism because, along with covenant theology, it holds that the church is the new Israel of God, the true Israel of God. But then you have dispensational premillennialism, which does two things. Says that the church is a basically Gentile institution, that after the rapture, God is dealing again in his alternating fashion with national Israel, both in the Great Tribulation and in the 1,000 years. Israel is persecuted in the Great Tribulation. Physical Israel is exalted to reign with Christ in the 1,000 years. Questions? So the unique thing about dispensational premillennialism is the two people of God theory, God dealing alternatingly in history with national Israel, then the mystery Gentile church, and then again in the tribulation millennium with national Israel, and built on that, the distinction between a pre-tribulational and post-tribulational phase or stage in the second coming of Christ. Too late in the day to ask questions, is it? Okay, let's proceed. Here's a table of differences then. That's just puts in diagram form what I've been saying so far. Okay? Okay. Yes, Andrew.
Would the relative novelty of dispensationalism in general, but especially dispensational premillennialism, shed light on its validity as a view?
Well, I think so. It certainly doesn't speak in its favor. The fact is that pre-tribulationalism, the idea that Christ comes before the tribulation and that his coming is in two phases, is unheard of prior to the 1830s in the history of the church. Now, you talk to a dispensationalist, either one, he's going to deny that, or two, he's going to say, oh, it's true, but it's a matter of the progressively unfolding understanding of the biblical teaching in the church. Now, they can do that, they can take that position, but that really doesn't look like the progressive understanding of the church, which means that usually that there is an increasingly clear understanding of something and not a completely novel idea, which is what pre-tribulationalism is. And it seems to have been born, and I'm going to quote some sources to this effect, born someplace in the congregation of Irving or Darby in the 1830s. Okay? So I think it's an argument against it. You'll get comeback from people, but it seems to me that this doesn't look like the normal progressively unfolding and increasing understanding of the church because it's completely novel. I wouldn't want to hold a position that was completely novel before. I would want to be able to point back to people that held it or at least something like it prior. Premillennialism is not novel. We may think it wrong, but it's not novel. But pre-tribulationism is entirely novel before the 1830s. Okay. Now, that's interesting, isn't it? If the premillennialism, you could do it this way. You could say, if you're going to make a big deal of premillennialism being taught in the early church, and that's a really significant thing, then shouldn't it be just as significant that the distinction between the church and Israel and the denial that the church is the true Israel and pre-tribulationism, isn't it then also significant? They are entirely absent in the early church? I don't see how you can argue, use the historical argument one way and at one point and then poo-poo it at another point. That doesn't seem to be consistent, does it? Okay. The triumph of dispensational premillennialism. You might not know it, but actually, even among the Plymouth Brethren, Darby was not, at one point, the only teacher. And in fact, there were prominent Plymouth Brethren who were not pre-tribulational. Leading Brethren teacher B.W. Newton took exception to Darby's position, and pose the question, is the church directed in Scripture to expect a secret coming of the Lord Jesus Christ? And he answered that with a resounding no. But despite the continued opposition of Newton, Darby's uncompromising zeal brought him to a place of dominance among the Plymouth Brethren, and it was his distinctive dispensationalism, which was therefore the brand of futurist premillennialism, which is in the best position to replace the collapsing historicist premillennialism in America. Darby himself brought dispensationalism to America. He visited seven times between 1862 and 1877. Though he had greater difficulty convincing Christians in America to withdraw from their assumedly apostate churches into brethren assemblies, his eschatology had enormous influence on many who did not withdraw. In other words, you know the context in England. You had all these, you know, Christians in the Anglican Church. It wasn't hard to make a case that the Anglican Church was corrupt and apostate. And so it looked pretty reasonable to leave your old Anglican Church, get together in these small brethren's assemblies, practice the Lord's Supper, and wait for the Lord to come back. When he came to America, he had churches that were not nearly as corrupt, were full-blown Protestant churches, evangelical churches, Baptist, Presbyterians. It was harder to convince them to leave their churches. So that part of the thing didn't really take off like it did in England. What took off here, however, was the dispensational eschatology. Darby made contacts with people who became important conduits of dispensational influence. Some of these were James H. Brooks, Dwight L. Moody, and through the prophecy and Bible conference movement of the late 1800s and the alliance with D.L. Moody, dispensationalism came to occupy a respected place in the united front of American premillennialism. So Moody was one of the great conduits, channels of this influence and his evangelistic ministry, and of course then through the inimitable Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. Okay? Now, dispensationalism was part of what might be called the United Millenarian Movement in America until the death of Brooks and other early millenarian leaders in the late 19th and 20th century. At about this period, first Nathaniel West and then Robert Cameron attacked the pre-tribulational position, and Arno C. Gebelein, lots of famous Gebelines in the evangelical world, responded for the pre-tribulational view. There's a famous Christian school in New England. I know a guy, Ken Brownell in London, that went to school there. And it's really famous because it's got really high academic standards. Ken went right from this famous Christian school in Long Island, I think, or New York someplace, right to Harvard University, and holds a doctorate from Harvard in history. But at any rate, one of the Gebelines, I don't know, I think it was Arno, was like the president or principal of that Christian school up there. Anyway, this prominent evangelical fundamentalist name. But the ultimate result was that dispensationalism attained dominance among premillennialists. Now, why did the pre-tribulationists emerge dominant? Why did they keep winning like this? Well, I think the first reason has to do with the fact that dispensationalists were more willing to continue the fight. They just wouldn't give up, and it was apparently for them a core doctrine, a vital doctrine. And then another important factor was the publication of the enormously popular Scofield Reference Bible in 1909. And with that publication, the dominance of pre-tribulationism was assured. But the second reason for the triumph of the dispensational view of Christ's second coming probably has more to do with the very nature or impetus or premises of the modern premillennial movement. What was that? Well, remember I said that one of the major things that led to the rise of premillennialism at the beginning was the imminence of Christ's return. Remember? And the imminence of Christ's return taught in the New Testament seemed entirely inconsistent with postmillennialism and its notion that 1,000 years at least had to pass before Christ comes back. But it seemed more consistent with premillennialism. But you see, dispensationalism embodied that imminence doctrine driven to its furthest extreme. And therefore, it kind of captured the inner drive and impetus of the rising premillennialism of the 1800s. Sandine says, perhaps more important was the continually reiterated argument of the pre-tribulationists that the hope of Christ's return had to be an imminent hope, or it was not hope at all. If one believes that a period of tribulation must first take place before the coming of Christ, they said, then he cannot look forward to the second advent, but must wait only for greater suffering. Regardless of the question of scriptural justification for one point of view or over the other, the pre-tribulationist position was certainly more likely to appeal to that portion of American Christendom which is attracted by the millenarian message. Now follow the logic here, okay? Christ's return is imminent. But now that doctrine of imminence receives a certain definition. By imminent, we mean no predicted event can happen before Christ's return. Otherwise, we're not looking for Christ's return, they said, but we're looking for the tribulation. And so if we're going to really believe in the imminence of Christ's return, that nothing, no predicted event can happen before Christ's return, that imminence means that Christ's coming is at any moment, then clearly Christ must come before the tribulation. See the logic? I mean, you can chart this out syllogistically, and it works perfectly. Christ's return is imminent. Imminence means at any moment, and therefore Christ must come before the tribulation. If he comes after the tribulation, his return is not imminent, defined as any momentness. Okay? So when that whole logic was driving the millenarian movement to begin with, dispensationalism simply seemed like the logical end and conclusion of the viewpoint, right? You see that? The whole immanence doctrine that drove the movement to begin with seemed to come to its logical, extreme, consistent conclusion in the pre-tribulationism of dispensationalism. Make sense? And I'm going to say this later. The arguments for pre-tribulationalism are not exegetical. They are based on theological deductions. One of them is based on the argument from immanence, and there's another one that is also theological rather than exegetical in character.
Thank you for listening to the Weekly Discourse. If you've been blessed by this week's discourse, please consider subscribing to the Man of God Network so that you can continue to be blessed with resources like these. If you'd like to learn more about Covenant Baptist Theological Seminary, visit us at cbtseminary.org.